I'd like to thank the college and Dr. Richmond for having me here and all of the panelists for participating. So I'm going to try to talk about some specific instances that we may not have covered in the prior talks and what should we be doing. These are my only disclosures. These are grants for research and surgical education. So when we think about other circumstances and which approach we should use, open, laparoscopic, TAP or TEP or ETEP or robotic, we can approach it from different ways. You know, what is the evidence base? But surgeons don't always follow the evidence. Sometimes we have to really individualize repair. So what do surgeons do? And again, what do patients want? When we look at bilateral inguinal hernias, what would the evidence suggest? Well, the endoscopic posterior approach is favored, and this is because of the shorter recovery and the effect of decreased pain compared to an open approach, and it makes sense. It wouldn't be even greater than for a unilateral hernia repair. And so the endoscopic posterior approach is recommended for a bilateral primary inguinal hernia if there is sufficient expertise, and this is demonstrated in multiple studies as well as outlined in the international inguinal hernia guidelines. We look at a recent study just published this year. This is a prospective randomized study looking at laparoscopic transabdominal preperitoneal, it's in a TAP versus a Lichtenstein repair for bilateral inguinal hernias. This was a simple randomization. They used the same anesthetic plan and postoperative pain management for both groups, and this was conducted in Spain. Only a year follow-up for the patients, but the patients reported decreased pain up to 7 days postoperatively, as Dr. Ramasani has pointed out in other studies. Postoperative complications were less, and this was mainly tied, the pain was mainly tied to patients who had complications, and there was less chronic pain in the TAP group compared to open. Most of the complications associated with the open inguinal hernia repair were related to incisional problems, incisional surgical site occurrences such as seromas and hematomas, and these mostly occurred in obese patients. So particularly in patients who had an elevated BMI, the laparoscopic approach probably favored. So that 79% of the open inguinal hernia repair patients who had complications had a BMI over 25, and this was only compared to 40% in the TAP group who had an elevated BMI of those who had complications. Again, there were only 8% rate of complications in the TAP group compared to 27%. What about recurrent inguinal hernias? What does the evidence suggest? Well, Dr. Apollos shared a lot of data about the rates of recurrence. When we look at this, if you're going to approach a recurrent hernia, The evidence would suggest an endoscopic preperitoneal repair for recurrence after an open repair. So if it recurs after a prior open repair, whether that was a primary repair, primary tissue repair, or a mesh repair, that you should consider a laparoscopic approach. And you should think about an open repair for recurrence after an endoscopic mesh repair. And this is what the data would suggest. But what do surgeons actually do? And if you were at the video session this morning and looking at the expertise that's available, well, it really depends. It depends on the patient, prior surgery. It depends on the surgeon experience as well as the local resources. So this is a recurrent hernia situation for patients who've had a plug and patch repair. And you have to keep in mind that despite the intentions, and this was an initial open approach, the plug and patch is really both an anterior and posterior repair because that plug protrudes through the hernia space. It's in the preperitoneal space. And so your approach then really depends on, well, what is the reason for surgery? Are you operating for this patient not just for recurrence but also for pain? In which case, a laparoscopic approach can really be a diagnostic measure as well. And if you can see in that picture, those plugs have really eroded well into the peritoneal cavity. To try to address a pain situation related to a plug from an open approach is going to be quite difficult. It's also quite challenging to do it laparoscopically, even with a lot of surgeon expertise, but it's possible to take down the peritoneum and get that plug out. And you can see the extracted plug there. So again, when you look at, see if this plays. Is that working? You can see how there's a recurrence just adjacent to that plug. We have the bladder filled there, so we can see that because the patient was actually having some bladder symptoms, that this is really an intraperitoneal situation. Well, what about a recurrent inguinal hernia after a laparoscopic preperitoneal repair? Really, as I mentioned, the evidence would point to doing this open. It's a valid repair. You stay it out of the operative plane. But for some patients, it can be diagnostic. And if somebody has had a preperitoneal repair, whether that's a TEP or a TAP, looking laparoscopically can help us see where the problem is and how to fix it. So this is a recurrence of where a mesh is lifted up, and you can see how that hernia sac is sliding up under the mesh there. So, but the feasibility of this really depends on the surgeon expertise, and this is really guided to the priorities of the patient and what is really bothering them. Now, if you are going to approach this from a laparoscopic standpoint, then a transabdominal approach is recommended. The TEP repair, you know, the peritoneum is going to be very fixed. So whether you do this robotically assisted or laparoscopically, you should use a transabdominal approach. What about the female patient? Well, the laparoscopic or robotic assisted approach really allows for inspection the entire myopectineal orifice with the least disruption. Dr. Paulus talked about a recurrence risk for somebody who had an inguinal hernia repair and then is found to have a femoral hernia and whether that represents a recurrence or not. We know that at reoperations, ephemeral hernia was found in about 41.5% of reoperations in females, but only about 5.4% in males. And recurrences actually are more common in females than males after a primary inguinal hernia repair. In general, actually, we found looking at ventral hernias as well that female patients fare worse, and that is across all BMI stratifications as well as race. What about the big direct inguinal hernia? And the for a female patient, a direct hernia, as well as an anterior approach or Lichtenstein approach, these are risk factors for hernia recurrences among women. And this comes from a Danish hernia registry cohort study. The majority of the patients had indirect inguinal hernias, about 61%, and the reoperation, about 5% needed reoperation for suspected hernia. The direct hernia was actually the risk factor for the recurrence. And then when you looked at the recurrence being a femoral hernia, not an inguinal hernia, this was actually higher in the patients who had a prior anterior repair as opposed to a laparoscopic repair. Again, going back to this direct hernia defect, if you do approach this endoscopically, the primary closure of the direct space is recommended as well as wide mesh overlap. This is from a recommendation for these large medial inguinal hernias, both in a TEP approach and a TAP approach. This comes from the consensus in international hernia guidelines as well as a registry study that looked at over 11,000 TAP repairs. There seems to be a higher recurrence rate for non-fixation of combined hernias as well as these very large medial hernias. What about patients who have had prostatectomy? Or have prostate cancer? We know that 33% of patients undergoing radical prostatectomy have an existing inguinal hernia. There's a growing number of these patients being approached robotically. We also know that if someone has had a radical prostatectomy in the past, about 15% of those patients are going to develop an inguinal hernia. So can these be approached at the same time with a robotic-assisted approach? This may be a real role for the robot-assisted approach in inguinal hernia repair. Now, if someone's already had a prostatectomy and they have an inguinal hernia, the open anterior approach is the most expedient and safer way, and this is really dependent upon surgeon experience. Some surgeons, if they are skilled endoscopically, will approach this with a transabdominal approach, either laparoscopically or robotic. Now, you've heard lots about repairs with mesh, and I just want to flip this to the other side to think about, not to forget, about tissue repair. When should we consider this? Well, there are going to be some surgeons who have preferences for tissue repair over putting mesh in the groin. There's also going to be patients who also prefer this, that they don't want a foreign body. We know that the mesh repair, hands down, repeated in multiple studies, is shown to have a decreased recurrence risk. But there are individual factors where patients and surgeons choose not to use mesh. For valid reasons. So there can be also contaminated cases where a mesh repair would be problematic. Of the tissue repairs that are there, shoulder ice repair is the most studied, and this imparts a lower recurrence rate compared to other tissue repairs, and the complication rate is also lower. We look at the recurrence rate after shoulder ice repair at specialty centers. It's quite low, 0.6 to 1.4%. But this can rise up to 15% as a recurrence risk when you look at non-specialty centers. And so if you're going to do tissue repair, I urge you to continue that your education on that so you can really offer a good repair with a low risk of recurrence. If you look at the international hernia guidelines for groin repair, there are a number of techniques out there, not just the shoulder ice. The Bassini has been studied many ways. It was mentioned this morning, the McVeigh, there's the Bastardo repair. There's a number of different open mesh techniques and endoscopic techniques. And when you look at so many different types of repairs for one problem, it goes to show that there's a lot of modifications and that maybe there's not one that's superior for every single patient. And when we look at this is true in terms of the recommendations. We know that for primary bilateral inguinal hernias, that a laparoscopic or endoscopic repair is preferred and recommended. If somebody's had, though, a lot of lower abdominal surgery, pelvic pathology, they've been irradiated, then you should consider an anterior approach. And really, you should tailor this based on your expertise, what your local resources are, and what the patient wants, of course. We can't forget that. So here's what we know from the evidence. We look at open repair, it should be done. Sure, there's a lot of evidence for someone who's had a posterior prior repair, preperitoneal repair. If you're doing the tissue repair, the shoulder ice really has the best supportive data. And then for patients who require local anesthetic as being representing the lowest morbidity and mortality compared to general anesthesia, for instance, for someone who has significant cardiac disease, then an open repair can be done. Now, while spinal anesthesia has been reported for TEP and TAP, it's very difficult to do. What about for the laparoscopic approach? If someone's had a prior anterior repair, then this is a good alternative, particularly if they have a bilateral inguinal hernia or a female patient or suspected femoral hernia in addition to the inguinal hernia. And then if somebody has a existing high preoperative chronic pain, for instance, even this is unrelated to the groin but might have chronic back pain, that person is at risk for chronic pain after groin repair. You might consider an endoscopic approach because the lower rate of chronic pain. What is the evidence for robotic assisted? You heard some of that already. I'd say for different approaches for these special circumstances we've been talking about, I think maybe if they're already having a robotic assisted pelvic surgery, there is a role for that. Now this is where there's not as much evidence, but maybe some approaches to think about. Again, someone who's had extensive lower abdominal surgery, then open is going to be probably the most feasible in most surgeons' hands. Somebody who is a peritoneal dialysis patient, who's had an irradiated pelvis, perhaps someone who is cirrhotic where you're forced to operate. Someone who's had chronic pain or a female patient who has pelvic pain that's vague and you can't really demonstrate a hernia on imaging, then a diagnostic laparoscopy may be appropriate, and you can combine that then with an inguinal hernia repair or femoral hernia repair as indicated. If there's a female patient, you do want to consider a laparoscopic approach. But if somebody is, if that patient is also desiring future pregnancy, you might think about a TEP approach or an ETEP approach to stay out of the peritoneal cavity entirely because you don't know about adhesions to even that peritoneal closure. If someone is at risk for hematoma, I think there's not solid evidence for this, but the rate of hematoma is less with a laparoscopic approach than open. But then again, the open approach, that space is contained. Whereas if you get a hematoma and bleeding in the laparoscopic approach, this is going to extend through the retroperitoneum and may be more challenging. For the future, the robotic assisted might be the way to go for somebody who has a high BMI, and this might save some pain on the surgeon side, as Arjuna mentioned. If someone has had both a prior anterior and posterior mesh repair, what do you do? Well, with a robot, you've got a magnified view, and it can be very helpful to do that very fine dissection with this type of approach. And if they're already having, for instance, a robotic prostatectomy, as I mentioned, robotic assisted may be superior. So the surgical approach should be tailored based on your expertise, patient factors, hernia factors, and local resources. The bottom line really with all of this is you do what you do best. That's what you offer your patient, but track your outcomes. And you also do what is right for the patient. And if the evidence shows that the approach that you don't do most often is the right thing to do, you have to think about, can I do it, or should I have that patient see someone else? Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay, so we've got about 15 minutes left, so we're going to open the floor up to questions. If the if interested parties would go to the mic, you'd be recognized, and we'd be happy to hear any questions or comments the audience would like to make. I'd like to start with one for the panel. Maybe Gina could take this on and then see what the others think. But what do you feel about the large inguinal scrotal hernia? I mean, historically, I would have said approach that open. I think with robotics, reduction of the viscera are quite a bit easier and can be done under direct vision. Do you have a strong perspective on that?
I've approached these laparoscopically with a transabdominal approach, and then now also robotically assisted, but really the easiest way to approach this is open, I think. Now, the thing, though, with the scrotal pier, sometimes what I found also that the floor is really disrupted, and that's why it's nice on an endoscopic approach to see the entire floor and also the viscera that's within that scrotal sac.
Yeah, so I'll approach those laparoscopically, but just like in many of the operations where you have to kind of break out of your mold of doing things the same way, you need to maybe alter your flap size, you need to maybe alter your mesh size, the amount of medial overlap and superior overlap. The posterior overlap, you're not going to make a whole lot of difference in, and you need to be prepared to make a counter incision if you can't reduce everything.
So I'm going to take the other side on this. As someone who does 90% of their hernias laparoscopically, the large inguinal scrotal hernia is certainly one that I would do open. And I think, you know, the concept of inguinal scrotal has many variations and nuances, but certainly when someone has a basketball-sized inguinal hernia, I think it gives you many more options and it allows you to do scrotoplasty concomitantly. So I think it's just much more pragmatic.
Yeah, I would agree with Scott. I tend to do these open.
I used to do these open until I started doing TAPS, because I used to do mostly TEPS minimally invasively, and that's a pain, a big pain in terms of doing those scrotals. But once I started doing TAPS with the use of the robot, I've started doing a lot of these minimally invasive.
Question from the floor. Are you speaking specifically about someone in whom you can't hold the anticoagulation for a significant period of time post-op, like say, for example, a mechanical mitral valve?
No, I'm talking about that. Okay. You have to consider when to restart the anticoagulation, how many hours of the decrease
the
risk of other things associated with
the
panel?
I approach those laparoscopically. The risk for hematoma and is greater with the open repair. I did mention that it is more of a contained space, but I feel that it's a little more problematic with a hematoma and infection potential risk with the open repair. So I'll do those laparoscopically.
Yeah, so I think it's important to make that distinction of you're able to either hold their anticoagulation or their antiplatelet therapy to the point where you can operate with some reasonable degree of safety. So in those patients, I'll approach those laparoscopically. In the very high-risk patients that we mentioned earlier where the bleeding risk is high, I'll tend to approach those open just because I feel like I can control things a little bit better. And if there is a issue afterwards, it's a little bit more easily handled. Yeah, I agree with that statement. In the very high-risk patients, it's probably more difficult to deal with a retroperitoneal hematoma than a hematoma anteriorly. But certainly, they're both challenging situations.
But I think that the point was well made by both the previous respondents that if you have a patient who has chronic AFib that you can hold it for 48 hours post-op, it becomes irrelevant. But in the high-risk patient, like in a mitral valve is the sort of the classic example of a person who has to be anticoagulated fairly rapidly post-op. And I think you can tell there's still a difference of opinion, but it's decreased instance of hematoma versus ease of recognition and management. So it's, once again, I'm not sure there's a right or a wrong answer, but those considerations are relevant.
I think also laparoscopic or robotically assisted, you can see some very, very tiny little vessels, which perhaps open, you may not think about or see that they're a problem, but later back on the anticoagulation might be an issue. So I find that to be a little advantage in the patient who is not super high risk.
Some questions? Yeah. I'm Mansoor from Springfield, Massachusetts. I want to start by thanking the panel and the moderators for this wonderful session. My question touches on surgical education. As Dr. Angela's presentation showed, that general surgeons who treat inguinal hernias need to be facile with both the minimally invasive techniques as well as the open techniques. But as an academic surgeon, I just do not feel that consistently or surgical graduates are comfortable with both techniques. And so what I would like to know is, do you agree that general surgeons in 2018 needs to be facile with both approaches? And do you feel that your graduates are consistently competent? And if not, how do we get there?
I think that's an excellent question, and William Hope, I hope will also answer this as well. I think, you're going to have the best outcomes, really, with the one approach that you do over and over and over and over again, as long as you're doing it correctly the first time. But I think, for the laparoscopic approach, you can see the entire myopectineal orifice, and so that approach takes care of the femoral hernias and directs, and you often see an obturator hernia as well, and you're going to treat all of that with a laparoscopic approach. And an open approach, I think in my hands, I don't feel as comfortable doing that. If I know there's a high suspicion of a femoral hernia, I'm going to approach that laparoscopically, because identifying that femoral hernia underneath, I think can be, under the inguinal ligament can be tricky. Now, as far as teaching, I do feel it's very inconsistent, and this is where it's helpful to have a set curriculum, a lab curriculum. We have that for our Hopkins residents, where you can teach the set technique, because they'll go out and you'll get a different approach with different attendings. I was operating with a resident recently, and we did a TAP approach for a woman who had a femoral hernia. And he was amazed about that anatomy. And I said, you should be seeing this anatomy every time you do a repair, whether it's a TEP or a TAP approach. So we still have work to do when we're talking about training our residents appropriately. But I think if you're already out there in practice, certainly you should perfect your art and go to courses and seek education and to be able to offer the best for your patient. But really refining that one technique is going to be very important.
Yeah, I won't belabor the point. I would up that one more and say that we need to be teaching tissue repair, which we do an incredibly horrible job at, and very few of us know how to do that, me included, very well. But I think the issue is laparoscopic or robotic, and the issue, which I hope I got across, is it's a very difficult operation to teach. So if you're talking about residents, yes, that's how we correct the problem. We teach them in residency programs. If you're out practicing surgeon, you're an open surgeon, it's very hard to look at that learning curve and say you're going to do that and get enough volume to be good at that. So I think that's where simulation helps. There's new simulators that will help with that. And then I think we got to teach our residents the proper techniques, which will help.
I actually think we've taken a little bit of a back step in our ability to teach open inguinal hernia repair. Our residents, people will tend to gravitate to probably the more perceived, kind of more attractive procedures to do. It's interesting, in my practice, at least at Vanderbilt, so I would see kind of a bimodal distribution of residents. So kind of I'd operate with the ones and twos, and then by the time the folks are going to private practice, are kind of about to go, I'll see them as chiefs, and they'll do a bunch of open inguinal hernias with me. And so I think that's an important point that we should also not forget how to teach a well-done open inguinal operation.
Phil Redlick from also conveyed my congratulations to the panel and the group for bringing an excellent discussion to this topic. Dr. Andrew was mentioning adhesions just briefly, and so I was wondering about how TAP and robotic, and you have that peritoneal suture line, and then you have presumably adhesions to that, which then theoretically would subject the patient to lifelong adhesions and lifelong risk of small bowel obstruction. Can you comment, or is there any information about adhesions to that peritoneal suture line that would put the patient at risk?
So in around the early 2000s, there was a number of studies that came out looking at TEP and TAP repair. I was a trained TAP surgeon both in my residency and fellowship, and so that's what I was most comfortable with. And as these approaches came out, one of the problems was bowel obstruction. And part of that really was not the adhesions to the closure, although that can happen with attacks. It was really because of the gaps in the closure of the peritoneum. About 15 years ago, I started suturing it laparoscopically and using a vicryl suture to do that. Now, robotically, a number of us are using barbed sutures, and there is some concern about the bars of the suture, especially leaving a longer tail. There's been some reports of adhesions to that. And so that I do think you have to be careful. And if I do a robotic assisted approach where I'm using like a ventral hernia and closing the peritoneum or an RTAP procedure, I'll travel that suture differently, if that makes sense, so that there's very little exposure of the actual suture on the abdominal cavity side, the peritoneal side, to really minimize that exposure. Because I do worry about adhesions, but as far as data to that, I don't know of any.
Oh, no, I was just going to agree with you in terms of the barbed sutures there, that I don't think there's data, but we've all seen or know patients that have had issues in terms of bowel obstruction with just a little bit of bowel that sticks onto a little bit too much to expose barbed suture there. And I think that for those of us when we started with barbed sutures and didn't really feel comfortable closing something up without putting a knot in, you need to get over that because you cannot have a knot on the outside with that much barbed suture exposed.
Next question.
I'll let Archana answer this. I know that we're talking about long chronic pain, so we're not talking about acute pain here. And I think most of the studies, it's long term, which is greater than 3 months after the hernia surgery. So I think you have to be careful about saying pain right after surgery. But if you're looking at long term chronic pain, the answer is nobody knows, but the thought is nerve damage. And all the nerves run anteriorly, or most of the nerves run anteriorly. And so it's thought to be that you have a higher incidence of injuring a nerve, which we think causes chronic pain, versus a laparoscopic or minimally invasive posterior approach. That you know, really only the lateral femoricutaneous nerve is exposed at that part. So maybe you can add.
Well, the only other thing which may have relevance to acute pain and why it seems that acute pain is less as well in the laparoscopic approach is that there's some studies, and they're very minimal and not that great so far in terms of what you can tell from it, suggest that the SIRS response may be lower as well when you're doing it in a laparoscopic method. Because even though you are creating a large plane posteriorly, anteriorly, I think there's a reasonable amount of trauma as well that you're performing, right, as you're creating that lateral space underneath the external oblique to get your tails of mesh. But that's, yeah, that's about as much as I know.
Just one comment. I was watching a certain 3 days back, operating a patient robotic. So the patient had open hernia repair as well as laparoscopic hernia repair before. So during surgery, femoral vein was injured. So I simply asked, why didn't you approach open in such a patient? But he said, I've been done since my residency open, so I don't know how to do open hernia repair. So I second that opinion that we should work on that as well.
So I just make one comment. I think that's absolutely true. And I think your question about why it hurts less is relevant. And I think a lot of times in surgery, we identify a phenomenon that we have a lot of theoretical explanations for, but it's very hard to get the data in a position to truly give you the answer that you want. We know it does hurt less. We don't completely understand why. And everything's theoretical. But ultimately, the metric, you know, of quantification of pain is less with laparoscopic, and this we know from outcomes.
I think just to make a quick comment on that, you know, with the opener approach, you're opening up the aponeurosis, so the external bleed, typically if you're going to do the, you know, the Lichtenstein approach at least. So there is a little more tissue dissection that you're doing that instead of just opening the peritoneum on a posterior endoscopic approach. The other is that the nerves, so when they exit in through the abdominal wall, you know, from the retroperitoneum, they are anterior there under that oblique. And so I think even in the short term, you may see some differences in terms of pain, particularly the way that I was taught with open repair is not the way I teach open repair now, you know, which is to sort of expose that ilioinguinal nerve or the iliohypogastric nerve with an open approach and pull it back behind and put clamps on. And you just, you know, you don't want to do that. I think all of those things increase the risk for pain.
Far Mike.
Eugene Cho from Tacoma, Washington. A comment and a quick question related to that. The comment, it has been a while since I looked at this. It may have changed. That's why I ran a comment in case it has. I'm not aware of it. But the Schulweis data was based on requirements, prerequisites to be operated on there with that technique. You were within 15% of your ideal body weight, not a smoker, and essentially very physically active so that you could walk from the operating room to the recovery room as part of your protocol back in the day. If so, it's still like that, then we have to be careful holding out them as a gold standard because we've got to talk about it and a built-in advantage, you know, only out there like the candidates. But so the related question then is, there's recent data that brings in a question our belief that our long-held prejudice that smoking increases cardiac recurrence, for example. Just based on that, now increased recent company data, what is your practice of the panel for the chronic smoking that kind of stops the burn?
So as far as the Schulweis data, I think that's a great point because that probably is some reflection of why no one can really replicate the Schulweis results because certainly in my practice, both in Middle Tennessee and Central Ohio, we don't limit it to such a narrow population. And I think if we did that with tissue repair, we would have recurrence rates all over the place. In terms of smoking cessation, or nicotine cessation, yeah, I think it's pretty unclear in terms of what the impact is on long-term recurrence. Personally, in my practice, I'll kind of tailor things a bit. If a patient says that they're able to stop, potentially long-term, or it's short-term, even with an opening little operation, we'll have that discussion. Maybe that'll happen. But as far as recurrence, I don't think it's nearly as clear. One important thing there is the chronic cough associated with it. I think, to me, that's probably more of importance than their nicotine use in inguinal hernia repair.
Yeah, just one comment on the Schulweis. I would agree with you. There's no doubt they cherry pick, but I would flip that question and say, well, then there is a subset of population, even that we see and we all see, that we could do a tissue repair on. And so, yes, we're never going to be able to replicate their data if we just take all comers. But I think it goes to Gina's point. You know, we also don't have to put mesh in every single patient. There are a subset of patients, if we all knew how to do a good Schulweis, where we could offer them that. And I think that's one of the problems is we're on all or nothing, and we really should be tailoring our approaches.
And one final comment as relates to smoking. Just always remember that inguinal hernia and complex abdominal wall reconstruction are two very different animals in how you approach that. So,
I'm Rahul from Boston, and I would like you to comment on the low weight and heavy weight mesh. I see your data, which presented, was weighted towards the ultra low weight meshes, but recently we had some conflicting data from Yale's surgery, the TOOL trial, where
so if I can just say one thing before we move on with that, is that I would make a difference between the ultra lightweight and the lightweight. And I think what most of these studies are looking at and what most of us talk about when we say lightweight is more kind of a midweight, if you want. It's just the words get very complicated at this point. I think the ultra lightweight, I think everybody has moved away from the standpoint that we just didn't think that that was strong enough in those areas and was associated with higher recurrence rates. I think it's still a little confusing in terms of if there is a truly significant difference between the mid-weight and the heavyweight mesh. And if there's no difference in recurrence, though, and maybe there's an improvement in pain, I think that's where a lot of people are moving more towards the mid-weight as opposed to kind of the traditional heavyweight mesh.
Yeah, and I think that's the important point. I mean, if the recurrence rates are, you know, splitting hairs, like we mentioned earlier, and there may be some benefit to the mid-weight mesh, especially in the open approach where comfort kind of becomes an issue with the prosthetic, I use a mid to low-weight mesh, and I tailor that based on the patient's size and other factors. Laparoscopically, I think we have some data where it may be either inverse or that difference isn't so much borne out, and I actually use mid to heavyweight mesh laparoscopically.
Jim Peacock, Rochester, New York. I enjoyed this discussion very much. My question has to do with the quality of data regarding outcomes in robotic femoral hernia repair. I feel that there is a lack of high quality, high volume data. I wonder if the panel agrees. It seems that this operation is accelerating in the community, it's being widely applied. Should we demand more data, or is it here to stay?
So I would agree with you. I think in any time there's a new technology or technique, it's going to take a little bit for data. But the data we have now is inconclusive. There is a randomized controlled trial that's close to being finished. Again, it'll probably be another year before that data is out. So there is more data coming. It's on the way. And I think, this is one of those things where the community runs with something, and we really don't know where it fits. And we see that in almost every new procedure or new technique we have. It just happens that way every time. But I don't know if y'all have comments.
I agree with you fully on that. And this is one of the that there's no data right now. And when folks started doing the R-TAP, I was very skeptical about that. I mean, I've been suturing the peritoneal and closed laparoscopy for a long time now. But and that was one of the advantages that people were touting, that to do the robotic, now you can do it transabdominal, you can close the peritoneum, you don't have to use tacks. The issue, I think, is this, that there could be real benefit, and there's some early studies looking at the robotic approach for complex abdominal wall hernia repair. But you can't go from not doing robotics to doing those cases. And so there's going to be this, this time period where we're really seeing a lot of robotic inguinal hernia approaches. Now, is that the right thing to do, based on data? We don't have enough now. Is that the right thing to do based on cost? And we heard from Dr. Roth that, no, that's probably not the right thing to do. But a surgeon has to sort of build that experience also, and you can't just jump right into that. Not that we want to practice on patients, you have to develop those techniques and train for it appropriately, but there are still going to be these cases that are being done that might not be the best case for that expensive approach, but that are needed.
Gina, question. So just based on the difficulty in learning laparoscopic inguinal hernia repair, do you think that as residents get more facile with robotics, that it'll shorten the learning curve for TAP?
I do. I will say that I feel very comfortable with our residents suturing the peritoneum closed robotically, and it's so painful to watch them suture laparoscopically. So for the teacher, it's helpful to me.
All right, last question.
How many robotic cases should you do a week? Like, we're going to call ourselves a robotic surgery.
Inguinal hernias or?
All.
Our hospital, and this is a low number, our hospital makes us do, I think, 40 cases in 2 years, so 20 cases per year. And if you don't do that, you have to either go through a simulation program or you have to be recredentialed.
Our hospital is 25. Yeah, our hospital is 25, but I can tell you that anybody who's actively involved in robotics is doing substantially more than that, but that's the institutional standard. But the point that's being made here is it varies institution to institution, and I don't really have a benchmark that I think is appropriate to even state.
But I mean, your question was, how many cases do you need to do to call yourself a robotic surgeon? My question would be, why do you need to call yourself a robotic surgeon?
I think you need more than that, but, 50 cases a year, maybe. Just a guess.
All right, I'd like to thank the audience and thank our panel members for what I think was a very nice session.